Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2005. Today's session is entitled The U.S. and Climate Change, presented by Philip Moat. Disc number MOP 2005-04.
If you haven't been in one of my sessions before, I'll give you a quick introduction. I'm a research scientist at the University of Washington. My specialty is climate, specifically climate of the Northwest and how it affects natural resources. And somewhere around slide 12, you'll see a couple examples of the research that my research group has done. Tonight, we have a special guest lecture as part of this. Steve Jones, who goes to my church in Seattle, is an engineer with a specialty in wind, and he's a consultant or he works at an energy consulting firm in Kirkland. And so he's going to spend a bit of time talking about the wind industry because it has a key role to play. So the topic for tonight is the U.S. and climate change. Oh yes, and I also have to introduce my son Nat. If you haven't been to one of my talks before, he's up in the second level clicking, and he spent a good deal of time exploring the functionality of Apple's keynote presentation software. So you're going to see some glitzy slide transitions provided by Nat, who will now stop using his laser pointer and be a responsible slide clicker. Okay, so let's have the first slide transition. There we go. So just to some background from the last couple of talks, there's clearly some very deep concerns, reasons for concern with global climate change. And the international agreement is to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations. So scientists are able to say with a fairly high degree of confidence that the only way to stabilize the climate is to have very deep cuts in emissions. If you remember the talk yesterday, I guess it was, about the Kyoto Protocol, which was talking about reducing emissions by 6 to 8% below 1990 levels. Well, to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations and therefore the climate, we would have to be talking about cuts of 60 to 80%. So regardless of whether the Kyoto Protocol is followed or not, it would by itself have very limited impact on the rate of global climate change. It is at best a first baby step. So to stabilize the climate, which is the stated goal of the United States and other signatories to the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change, there will have to be very deep cuts. Now, the level of dangerous climate change, some of the things we talked about yesterday, of sea level rise, spread of vector-borne diseases, and so on, is likely to be reached sometime in this century. And in fact, could in some definitions be reached as early as 20 years from now. So to stop at a level that falls short of dangerous, which again is the stated goal of the United States and other signatories of the 1992 treaty, would require that these deep cuts happen soon, that they begin very soon, and that they be completed within a few decades. To do something like that would require a large-scale transformation of the global economy away from fossil fuels toward renewable energy. And we'll talk about some of the specific things that need to be done or could be done a little bit later in tonight's session. Just a quick recap of what we've done in this series. We started out just considering some background, the lessons of global stewardship that we get by reading the Bible, and also some lessons in how to tackle these global environmental problems that began in the 1960s and 70s with acid rain and ozone depletion, two problems that have largely been addressed through the joint efforts of scientists, businesses, and governments. On Tuesday and Wednesday, we talked about some of the science of climate change, and on Thursday, today, we're going to specifically focus on the U.S. Tomorrow, we shift gears again to what's probably even a more long-lasting problem than climate change, and that is species extinctions, because once species are extinct, they don't come back. So that is a sort of permanent environmental problem. So today, wow, we have bouncing list. So Today we're going to break it down into four pieces. Impacts of climate change on the U.S., talking about the U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases compared with those of other nations, the political environment, things that politicians and businesses are saying and doing, and then finally, solutions to climate problems, specifically thinking about the U.S. Okay, here's a cartoon. I love global warming cartoons. It's, you know, all these polar animals. You know, climate change is going to mean that seals take up steel drums, Caribbean. The head of our research group is from Trinidad, and when he was in high school, he was a steel drummer, back before it became sort of a globally known music form. Anyway, so will this happen? Will the polar bears have to wear Hawaiian shirts? We'll get to that. We talk about different aspects of climate change globally, but I want to focus now on the U.S. This is from a paper that was recently published looking at heat waves. And this is the pattern of the severity of heat waves, defined as the annual three-day warmest minimum temperature. So the biggest problem with heat waves is when it doesn't cool off at night. And so you just look at the average warmest 3 days of the year, how warm is that? And of course the Southeast is the worst and the Northwest is the best. We basically never have heat waves here. It's unusual if the nighttime low temperature in Western Washington is above 65. It hardly ever happens. This is observed. This is the model distribution, very similar. And what the model says is that in a future warmer climate, there's a big increase in heat wave frequency, both in the Southeast and on the West Coast. So not as much to worry about if you're up in Minnesota, North Dakota. It's probably already about as bad as it can get. So that's just one dimension of climate change. Here in the Northwest, we're very concerned, of course, about snowpack, because 70% of our stream flow, annually average, comes from snowmelt. And this is a simulation with a hydrology model that we have at our research group at University of Washington. So this is the average April 1st snowpack pattern for the 20th century. The amounts of snow are given here. So very deep snow just a little bit west of us in the North Cascades. And if you think about a warming to the 2050s, the Northwest as a whole would lose about 35% of its snowpack, and by the 2090s about 50%. But the losses would be much more acute here in the Cascades. So this is just zooming in on the Cascades, 59% for the 2050s and over 70% for the 2090s. And this is particularly acute in Oregon, where essentially by the 2090s, the April 1st snowpack would be gone. And this, of course, is going to have huge impacts on stream flow, as we'll see in a minute. But is that something that's just off in the distant future? Well, this is some research that we've done in our group looking at these. I showed this a couple of days ago just for the Northwest. These are locations on the left. This is Western North America. I know it's a little faint, but here's Washington, here's the Bay Area. These are locations where Department of Agriculture monitoring for stream flow predictions show either declines in red or increases in blue. And 75% of the locations in the West have seen declines over roughly the last 50 years. Because we were concerned about whether things like reforestation, trees growing back, would be affecting these trends, we did a simulation with that same hydrology model just using weather inputs. So the model knew nothing about the actual snow on the ground, and point-to-point matches are extremely good, and it turns out that the fraction of model grid points showing declines was also 75%. So there are some mismatches at certain locations, but overall, the message is large declines have prevailed in the western U.S. over the last 50 years, and they've been the largest percentage losses have been, guess where, in the Cascades, just as the model predicted for the future. Now, these big increases in the Southern Sierra are driven largely by the fact that precipitation has increased, but also by the fact that the Sierra Nevada Mountains south of Lake Tahoe are extremely high elevation, a lot of terrain above 10,000 feet, and it's basically so cold that a little warming doesn't change the amount of snow on the ground on April 1st. So clearly, this projected impact of climate change, of reduced snowpack, is already happening. And a couple of spots here are just west of here in Lyman Lake. It's one of the locations they monitor, and it's fairly high elevation, so the trends to date have been quite small. So this area is not quite as vulnerable as lower elevation areas in the Cascades. This is, as I said, the projected impacts of on stream flow. So what's shown here is the monthly average flow, shown in black, for simulated 20th century flow, October through September. So the peak is in the spring, even though the peak precipitation in the, most of the West is in the winter. That's because snowmelt is dominating. This is the Snake River, where it flows into the Columbia, just a little southeast of here. That if you add the warming expected for the 2020s and the 2040s, which is only a few degrees Fahrenheit by the 2040s, you see these very large reductions shown in this red curve, very large reductions in summer flow, a slight shift toward earlier peak flow, and increases in winter flow. Now, I won't show you the gory details, but these predicted changes, too, have already been observed through in most of the West. Declines in summer flow, increases in winter and early spring flow, and a shift toward earlier peak flow. This, of course, this reduction in summer flow is very worrisome for municipal water supply, irrigated agriculture, fisheries throughout the West. And a lot of water agencies are now beginning to recognize this concern and deal with it. This is obviously not the same magnitude of concern as, say, wiping out the island of Tuvalu, which we talked about yesterday, but nonetheless, it is going to probably drive some irrigated farmers out of business here in the Northwest.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
If they're already seeing those things, does that change that timeline? I mean,
well, essentially what it's saying is, you know, that this base case is a 50-year simulation. And what it's saying is that there was already a bit of change during that 50 years. And so if you were to parse that out as, say, a 1990s average versus a 1950s average, you'd see some of those changes already occurring. Looking at the actual data in some rivers, it doesn't stand out above the noise level, but in most moderate elevation basins, it does already. Okay, let's move on to forest fires. This is a graph of the average, the total area burned. This is hundreds of thousands of acres for the state of Montana. And this is typical for a lot of the states in the West. There were a lot of big fire years in the 1920s and 30s. And then just focus on the solid curve for now. And then after World War II, it really dropped off. And then in the early 80s, it kind of jumped up again. And the standard story that's told is that this is entirely because of fire suppression efforts, that particularly after World War II, when the men returned home, there was a big effort toward protecting property in forested areas and putting out wildfires, and this allowed the fuel to build up, which became unhealthy for the forests, and so there was a reversion to allowing more fires in the 1980s. That story is partly true, but there is an important climate component to this as well. The dotted curve here represents a simple statistical representation of the role of climate in the average area burned. And what this suggests is that these fairly burny years in the 20s and 30s were partly because the climate was favorable. And from 1940 to 1980, there was only one year this is summer climate we're talking about, when the climate was favorable for wildfire. And then you got a return to the somewhat more burning years, and particularly 1988, which was the second biggest burn year in Montana, the climate said that that would have been probably the second biggest burn. So there's clearly a climate component. Another way to look at this, go ahead, is to plot each of those years in terms of the summer climate. So I'm going to walk you through this diagram. Go ahead and click once now. So this is the summer climate relative to the average. So if it's the direction in the x direction is how warm it was, so the warm years are off to the right. Precipitation is the up-down direction. So if it's dry, it's down. If it's wet, it's up. So you can see that the years themselves are sort of scattered along this warm, dry, cold, wet. Now the size of the symbol indicates the area burned in that particular year. And here's 1988, the second biggest year. Here's 2000, the biggest year. Basically, what this shows us is that warm, dry means bigger fires. Well, duh. And yet, U.S. policy with regard to forests is currently predicated on the notion that climate doesn't matter for forest fires. Mm-hmm. Now, let's think about where we might be going. This red arrow is from the mildest climate model we could find, the projection for where summer climate in Montana will be. A little bit wetter, only about 1.5 degrees warmer, and that's by the Celsius, so about 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by the end of the century. This is the nicest model we could find. And if you just look at this too, this means that the average area burned will roughly double, or in fact the head of the arrow is closer to a tripling. Yes?
I was going back to current government policy. Is that current administration policy, or is that kind of an ongoing policy?
Yeah, the policy is we have to reduce fuel loads because the fuel loads are too high, and that's the reason we're getting all
the
wildfires.
But is that this current administration's policy? Okay,
yes.
It was, okay, that's what I want to know.
That was, I think it was underway in 2001 already, but it was a policy pursued with much vigor by the administration because part of reducing the fuel loads, one approach is to substantially thin the forest for commercial timber.
Got it.
Yeah. There's much more interest in thinning the forests that have commercially valuable timber than the ones that don't.
Right.
So Montana expected at least a factor of 3 increase in the average area burned. Now, this is a sort of simple statistical approach, but we published this paper last year. Let's just look at the state of Washington. Similar kind of diagram, but again, roughly a factor of 3 increase. And incidentally, we don't have the last couple of years. Our analysis ended in 2002, but the years 2003 and 2004 were both way down here in the corner, exceptionally warm and dry, and we really lucked out. We didn't get big fires, but in 2003, British Columbia had tens of thousands of acres burned. So we definitely had the right conditions for a great big circle down here, but it just didn't happen. I don't know if that's because Christopher was praying hard or what, but I know the fire that happened here last year was a big enough of a headache having to evacuate the village. Part of the talk, comparing the U.S. with other nations. Go ahead. The bottom line is that if you look at global emissions of carbon dioxide, for 1995, the U.S. was about a quarter, 22%. The entire developing world, China, India, Latin America, Africa, Middle East, the rest of Asia, was about 27%. So the U.S. alone was emitting as much as the poorest, roughly 3.5 billion people on the planet. So very big difference. In fact, we're only about 5% of the world's population and we're emitting 22% of the CO2. This was in 1995. Expected by 2035 that this developing part will grow much more rapidly so that it will be about half of the emissions by 2035. And so if you remember my comments yesterday about the Kyoto Protocol being designed so that these nations would take the first step, the intention was that these nations would be involved in the second step because their emissions are growing so rapidly. China is expected to overtake the US and become the largest emitter in about 20 years. Let's look at a few details, because it's interesting if you take that number of CO2 emissions and divide it by different quantities and then look at how it's changed over time. So in this case, it's CO2 emissions per unit of economic output, measured as GDP. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, which basically is the 28 wealthiest nations in the world, from the U.S. down to Mexico, is in red, and you see that from 1980 to 2001, the developed world got much more efficient, going from, in fact, about 50% in decrease, sorry, a 30% decrease in what's called the carbon intensity. Up here above the OECD are developing Asia, i.e. China chiefly, and Indonesia. The Middle East and North Africa, shown in black, which actually increased, particularly in the 1980s, cheap oil meant, hey, let's just use oil for everything. And way up here, EE and FSU, meaning Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union. Very inefficient economies. And look what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the other communist countries between 1989 and 1991. Huge drop, and that was basically because the economies collapsed, not because they got more efficient. The GDP just absolutely plummeted. But they have been making some progress at weeding out the least efficient plants. Just to give you a mental picture of what this means, I have a colleague who has spent a lot of time in Kyrgyzstan, and he says, you know, you go there in the winter, and you've got these huge apartment buildings that have a single central heating unit pumping out vast amounts of heat, and the only temperature regulation people have is to open the window. So it's minus 20 outside, and you see these apartment buildings with all the windows open, because there's just too much heat going on. So, you know, this is a case where with a little bit of money, you can vastly reduce their CO2 emissions just by making things a little more efficient. Let's look at things in a little different way. This is energy consumption per person or per capita. And here, the US and Canada come out on top. Here's Canada, here's the US. Canada, of course, wins because it's so dang cold up there that they have to use a lot of energy just for heating. But look at all of the European countries down here and Japan. The U.S. Red line here. Basically, variability around a nearly constant value of energy consumption per capita. Germany, again, with the collapse of Eastern Germany in 1989, a lot of inefficient plants closed, so their per capita consumption went down. Japan's rising modestly. Here's Italy. The UK, as we saw, has actually had reduced CO2 emissions in total. But the main point here is that just the absolute numbers, not so much the trends, the US and Canada are way up here, and Europe is down at about half that. And the lifestyle in Europe is definitely not, you know, half the quality of life that we have here. It's just a more energy efficient economy. A lot of that has to do with house size and transportation choices. So that's the first graph. Let's look at the next one. This is the amount of, this is like the one we looked at in the previous slide. This is the energy consumption per capita, which is a lot like the CO2 emissions per capita. Again, Canada on top, the U.S. next, and then Europe down significantly lower.
Wait, you mean per GDP?
Right, thank you. It's energy consumption per GDP. So this is the energy intensity. Now, this has an interesting historical value, because in 2001, when President Bush announced that he was pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol and was going to come up with something better, he then said a few months later, what we're going to do is reduce the energy intensity by 18%. Now, if you look at the red line, and that was over 10 years, that was the goal, reduce energy intensity by 18% over 10 years. If you look at the red line, this is the energy intensity. It's gone down by about 30% in 20 years. And the projected change in energy intensity from 2000 to 2010 without any policy was 14%. So he was talking about a very small increment, but most people don't know what energy intensity is, so gee, you know, improving it by 18% sounds like a really good, you know, ambitious goal. Of course, it would still allow CO2 emissions themselves to rise. Okay, let's look at the third graph then. This is what really matters. This is the total carbon dioxide emissions. And look at the US way up here, and the other G7 countries way down here. Germany, Japan, and then Italy, UK, Canada. They're all way down there. Now, they are smaller countries, but you add them all up and their emissions still only come to about half of the US emissions for a comparable number of people. And more important, the CO2 emissions are rising in the US. Now, there was a slight drop from 2000 to 2001 because of the recession. These are the latest figures I could find from the Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration. But I suspect that what's happened as we come out of the recession is CO2 emissions have started climbing again. So what really matters to the climate is how much is this country putting into the atmosphere. And we know that we're number one. So these are the sort of more nuanced, detailed stories, but the real picture is that the US is the biggest emitter and rising. So if you don't like graphs, here's a textual summary. Just cycle through the bullets here. That's a spiffy transition, don't you think? This is not a Microsoft product, by the way. It's Apple's keynote software. So the bottom line is that the US CO2 emission is far larger than any other nation's, and it's rising, although China is catching up. Much larger per capita than Europe, roughly twice as much per capita. It's smaller per unit GDP than these fairly inefficient economies, Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union and the Middle East and North Africa states. But the output per GDP only really matters if you're thinking about perhaps spending money in a certain place to improve overall CO2 emissions. So let's move on to the third topic, which is the political environment in the US. So go ahead. Most people would think of it, first bullet please, as it's all George Bush's fault that the US is doing nothing. And that's a convenient view, you know? It's nice to have a scapegoat. It's nice to be able to say, oh, well, you know, what can we do if George Bush doesn't care? He took us out of Kyoto, you know, he's from the oil industry. He obviously doesn't care about this subject. What I'm actually going to show you is that there's a more nuanced view, both of the administration and of the bigger picture, because our nation is much more than one person, even if it's the president. We have a Congress, we have 50 state governments, we have thousands of local governments, we have hundreds of thousands of businesses, and of course 300 plus million citizens. And it's all those others that provide the rest of the picture. And what I'm going to say is there are both reasons for pessimism and optimism. So the reasons for pessimism are, number one, yes, George Bush did take us out of the Kyoto Protocol. But the reality is that the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated in 1997. Clinton was in office for just a little over 3 more years, and he never submitted it to the Senate for ratification. Why not? Because he knew it wouldn't pass, because it included no mandatory cuts for developing nations. And the Senate had said in the summer of 1997 they would not ratify any treaty that did not require cuts from developing nations. So you certainly can't blame the failure of Kyoto in the US on George Bush. He did pull us out, but had he submitted it for ratification, it would have simply been a political embarrassment to him because the Senate would have voted it down. The question, though, is will the US be involved in any subsequent treaties post-Kyoto? And there have already begun to be negotiations about what will happen after Kyoto. The US is still a member of the Conference of Parties, which are the signatories to the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change, and the US still goes to the annual meetings of the Conference of Parties, where these discussions are taking place. The question is, will the US participate meaningfully in any future obligations? So it is certainly a huge shame to the US. Now, more recently, last summer, we had a certain senator from Oklahoma, who I won't name by name, but first name begins with I, you can pretty easily look him up if you're curious, who stated last summer that global warming is perhaps the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. He followed this up with a quasi-scientific diatribe in January in which he highlighted some of the evidence against human influence on the climate, and cited very approvingly as one of his sources Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear, which, as I said yesterday, you know, it is fiction. It should come with a warning label. And this was shameful, that on the floor of the U.S. Senate, somebody could misrepresent the science of climate change so grotesquely. So that's certainly a reason for pessimism. A third just happened a few weeks ago. A certain representative from Texas, known locally by the nickname Smokey Joe, because he's so friendly with polluting industries, he wrote five letters to prominent scientists and to the head of the National Science Foundation concerning a paper published in 1998 on what's called the hockey stick. And I showed a figure of it yesterday, or the day before, I guess it was, showing that temperatures over the last 1,000 years sort of fluctuated around until you got to 1900, and then there's been this big uptick. He demanded that Michael Mann and these others submit all of the computer programs that they had ever used in their research, and all of the data sets that they had ever used, and an explanation of their funding sources. And it was just a big blow to the scientific community, because it was sort of like being keel-hauled. You know, we are used to doing battle inside the scientific community. You give a talk at a conference, and people might criticize your methods or you know, have different ideas. But you know, to have a member of Congress say you got to submit hundreds of computer programs is just shocking. So this was clearly an attempt to intimidate and harass these scientists whose work featured prominently in the last report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I'd say the biggest reason for pessimism is there are all these polls out there that, you know, ask the American people, what do you think of climate change? Is it a problem? And most people say, oh yeah, you know, 70% plus of the population will say, oh yeah, you know, climate change is a problem. Somebody should do something about it. And yeah, it's somebody else should do something about it. George Bush should do something about it. He should solve the problem for us. And if you actually look at the way people's purchasing decisions reflect their stated values, they'll even express some willingness to pay in these polls. Oh yeah, you know, I'd be willing to pay, you know, $250 a year to solve global warming. If you actually look at the support for things like renewable energy, I mentioned yesterday that a lot of utilities will allow you to pay a little extra premium to buy more renewable energy. The fraction of people that do that in Seattle, probably one of the greenest cities in the country, is I think around 5%. They were thrilled that 5% of their customers would pay a little extra for green sources, but you know, that's not very many people living up to the polls. So there certainly are a lot of reasons for pessimism, and this stems from the very nature of this problem being so long-term, and that the consequences are so distant. And it's like, well, why should I do something right now that's only going to start mattering 20 years from now? People have a problem with that. I've tried to say in this series that the reason that we should care about this is simply that we want to be good stewards of the planet and leave it in good working order for the next generation. And I'm glad to see several members of the next generation in the audience here. Because, hey folks, we're leaving you some real problems to clean up. Let's look at reason for optimism. So this is the cartoon illustrating that point. Our extended forecast includes global warming and the catastrophic end of the human race. But for the weekend, it looks like sunny skies and an apathy toward environmental concerns. Which I think sort of sums up that last point. So let's look at reasons for optimism. Boing. Well, what did George Bush actually say when he took office? Shortly after taking office and pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol, he asked for a National Academy of Sciences panel to comment on the science of climate change. And on June 11th, 2001, he stood on the White House lawn with Dick Cheney, I think this is Paul O'Neill, Christy Whitman, head of the EPA, Spencer Abraham, and Colin Powell, and said, we know the surface of the Earth is warming, and we don't know how much our climate change will change in the future. Now, a lot of the things that have been said in the administration have focused on this we do not know part, but it has always been the administration's stated position that there is some evidence of human influence on climate. And President Bush reiterated that last month in preparation for the G8 meeting in Scotland, where he said, yes, we understand that humans are changing the climate. So lip service, at least, from the administration about the role of humans in changing the climate. But more than lip service, in fact, the president created the Climate Change Technology Program, or CCTP, which is investment. Its basic goal is to invest money in the technology for renewables, especially things like solar, with the view to making them economically competitive, to driving the costs down to the point where they are actually able to compete with fossil fuels. And as you'll hear from Steve in a minute, wind power is already there, and that's why I wanted to have him give a more detailed talk about that. So the CCTP is providing some efforts toward, not toward the traditional kind of, let's require this amount, but toward making it economically competitive. A second reason for optimism was a sense of the Senate resolution passed in June that acknowledged, and it passed 55-43, so a substantial majority, and quite a number of Republicans voted for it as well. It basically acknowledged the science that humans are changing the climate, and it said the Congress, it did not say the president, it said the Congress should craft policies aimed at mandatory cuts of emissions. Now that word mandatory would have given fits to most senators even 5 years ago, but the fact that 55 are willing to support it now, I think is a real reason for optimism. It's paved the way for real action from Congress. Now, this representative from Texas that I mentioned was promptly chided in letters from both sides of the aisle, most notably the chairman of the House Science Committee, Sherwood Bowler, from New York, absolutely blasted him, said this is a completely irresponsible thing to do. If you genuinely have any interest, hold hearings. Don't demand that these guys submit their computer code. That's just absurd. Furthermore, this is all of this is just talk, but the northeastern states and more recently Washington, Oregon, and California have concocted regional initiatives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just to give you an idea of how states working together can be really powerful, one of the things that these three states are doing is electrifying truck stops on the I-5 corridor. Long-haul truckers pull in, they need to sleep, they're required by law to sleep, to have breaks of a certain number of hours for every 24. So they'll pull into a truck stop and they want to run the air conditioner or watch the TV or keep their fridge running or whatever, so they'll just leave their motor idling. Yeah, well, that's a very inefficient way to make electricity, but if you just put a little power outlet there, they can plug in their truck and turn off the motor. So this is one example where a little bit of initial investment can make a big difference. Another example is that California recently passed very stringent automobile emission requirements on CO2. Now, under the Clean Air Act, states are allowed to set their own limits on emissions of certain gases. California has always had more stringent emissions for gases other than CO2, and all they did was say, we're now going to regulate CO2 as well. Now, CO2 is not a pollutant in the traditional sense. And the automakers squawked that this was, a backdoor effort at requiring fuel efficiency, but they lost in court, I think that's being appealed to the Supreme Court, but it looks favorable that this law will go through. Meanwhile, Oregon and California have passed Oregon and Washington have passed similar laws. Actually, Washington passed a law that was contingent on Oregon passing a law as well, but in Oregon it's going to be done by the governor. He doesn't actually have to get the legislature to sign it. He's going to do it as an executive order. So there are some things happening on the state level, some very concrete actions underway. Also, the Cities for Climate Protection, this effort that's been underway for about 10 years, And more recently, Mayor Greg Nickels of Seattle announced that Seattle city government was going to abide by the Kyoto Protocol and meet those same emissions reductions, submitted this to all of the cities who were members of the National Conference of Mayors, and virtually all of them signed on to it. Turns out it's fairly easy for a city to make drastic emissions reductions. They have very rapid fleet turnover in their cars, you know, compared with the public at large. So every couple of years they're buying new cars, and if they buy a whole lot of hybrids, they can very rapidly change the city government emissions. Finally, business leadership, and I think this is where the rubber really meets the road. It's one thing for governments to take these little steps, but when businesses are genuinely engaged, that's very promising. And there's a lot of examples of companies that are taking their commitments, that are making commitments and taking them seriously. They're summarized by the Pew Business Environmental Leadership Council, and the pewclimate.org website has a list of all of the businesses that belong. They have to be very large businesses. Here are some examples of companies that have actually set about making reductions. The shining example is British Petroleum. In 1998, the chairman, Sir John Brown, or no, Lord John Brown, now made a commitment to reduce the company's greenhouse gas emissions by 10% by the year 2010. So a 12-year time span for making these emissions reductions. And they introduced a cap and trade system. So each business unit in the company was given an allotment of how much greenhouse gas they could emit. And they had to, it was obviously below their existing level of emissions. And then the ones that were very efficient about reducing could sell the credits to another unit in the company that had to buy them. This was so phenomenally successful that they met their reduction goal, not in the originally planned 12 years, but in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And this then became a model for the cap and trade system adopted by the European Union, where each of the nations has an emissions target under the Kyoto Protocol, and they're applying that very broadly. And at that point, BP just pulled out of its experiment and said, okay, we've succeeded, and now we're going to be part of this bigger thing. So this is just a phenomenal example of a company remaining profitable while reducing emissions. Now, I have to say, in fairness, that they are still pumping oil out of the ground. That is their main business, and they're still, you know, responsible for those CO2 emissions in the sense that they're providing them for their customers to make. But their own business operations are substantially leaner. And as I said the other day, BP is now styling itself beyond petroleum, and they're getting into renewable energy in a big way. Alcoa, the aluminum company of which Paul O'Neill was the president before he went to serve as Treasury Secretary under Bush, he started underway a goal for Alcoa to reduce their emissions, and since then it's been stated at 25% below 1990 levels by 2010, so much more aggressive than the Kyoto Protocol goals. And why is that? Well, Alcoa, you know, makes aluminum. Aluminum requires a huge amount of electricity. If they can do it more efficiently, it's going to affect their bottom line, particularly when the cost of electricity are rising. Toyota, of course, manufacturer of some very green vehicles, already reduced their energy per unit production by 15%. They have future reduction goals for CO2. Here are a bunch of other companies that belong to the Pew Leadership Council. So I certainly don't want you to think that the private sector is unified behind the coal industry in opposing any efforts on greenhouse gas emissions. I think there's a very large component of the private sector that recognizes it makes good business sense. Not just greenwashing, saying, oh, you know, here's our green credentials, but actually using it to make the business more efficient. So the final step here, solutions, and part of which I'm going to turn over to Steve. This is just one scenario of global growth in total energy. The top line here is the total energy growth. And most people think it will double, triple, or even quadruple in the next 50 years. And the different colors show the sources of the total energy. starting with simply cutting down trees and burning them. This is traditional biomass. Burning coal, that's the gray. Oil and natural gas, oil and, I don't remember what that is. Natural gas liquids, thank you, Steve, are green, and then natural gas is this pale color here. So the total carbon dioxide contribution is the top of this curve here, and in this optimistic scenario put out by Royal Dutch Shell, it peaks in about 2025 and declines. Then what could possibly make up the difference? Well, huge growth in wind and biomass, that's like ethanol and biodiesel, and solar. What would it take to get us there? We'll get to that in a minute. What will it take? Vigorous policy action. These kinds of transformations don't happen just in a laissez-faire environment. For starters, the U.S. would have to remove the subsidies for fossil fuels, which total in the on the order of several tens of billions of dollars a year, both directly and indirectly through military protection. Tax credits for renewables. You'll hear from Steve about the role of tax credits in the wind industry. Investing in renewables, like the Climate Change Technology Program. Continued and greatly expanded enthusiasm for this transition from the private sector and from the buying public. This is a sort of macro scale, U.S. as a whole. But there are things that we individuals can do as well. And that's where it really matters. The number one thing, according to Union Concerned Scientists, is to reduce our consumption of gasoline. And in response to a question yesterday about the airline industry, I pointed out that flying is roughly the same amount of fuel of CO2 production as driving a given distance. So, but it's not included in the Kyoto Protocol. So we're, as far as Europe is concerned, flying doesn't matter. But if you really want to affect your own CO2 emissions, you might think about flying less as well as driving less. Now this means more than just driving less. It could mean driving more fuel efficient vehicle or using public transit more. Supporting renewable electricity is another thing individuals can do. Buying more efficient appliances and retrofitting buildings. And finally, be heard. This is an issue that is so kind of pervasive and endemic that it can safely be ignored by politicians for another year or another term. And they won't really move on this, nor will businesses really move unless people are telling them by buying the products, writing letters, and so on. So these are really important actions as well, and your investment portfolio, if you have one, is another means for communicating. So here's my dad in his Toyota Prius. He was one of the first kids on the block to own one when they came out, 50 miles per gallon. He's very proud of it. And here's my mom and her new Toyota Prius, just bought a few months ago. And here are both Toyota Priuses. So they're very very committed to fuel efficiency, as you can see. So let's leave it here for Steve to take it out.
Thanks, Bill.
Wait, can you
come back? Yeah, that's there in case Steve wants to say anything about it before he goes on.
You'll see that wind is a very small current contributor, but is, at least according to this forecast to grow a lot, and it has a lot recently. Go ahead, Matt, we'll get right into it. I'm going to skip right past this one. That's me. Global Energy Concepts is the firm I work with. I'm going to talk about an overview of the market worldwide and in the U.S. for wind power, what's making that market happen, what's changing it, the overall view of the economics of wind power, and then take a look at the technology behind wind power, what's inside those big machines you may have seen on the horizon. Go ahead, Matt. Okay, the 6 gigawatts, which is installed capacity, 100 watt light bulb is 100 watts. This is giga is a million watts of installed wind power capacity. You see it's in the U.S. was an early leader here with a lot of development in California in the 80s. Since then, Europe has completely taken off and dominated. And as of the end of last year, the world had about 47 million watts installed, led strongly by Germany, with Spain and the U.S. behind them, and Denmark and India. Tied for fourth place, I guess that is. That's interesting perspective on that is Germany is, you know, is a much smaller country than the United States, but through a lot of aggressive policy and I think an overall view of looking at climate change and other environmental issues much more aggressively, they've dominated the world wind market. And Spain has more recently taken up the charge, and all their 8 gigawatts, or a substantial portion of that, is quite recent, just in the last 5 years or so. Go ahead, Matt. This is focusing on the U.S. It should say United States installed capacity along the left side, and the numbers got clipped off here. But at any rate, this is the early development in California. There were a number of state of California and federal policies that combined to have a lot of development in 3 areas in California. Then almost nothing happened in the mid-90s. The industry in the United States went to bed, and suddenly it picked back up again. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The technology has evolved quite a bit. It's become more cost competitive. But there was a federal tax credit. It's called the production tax credit. It's 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour of tax write-off for the business that actually owns the machines that produces them. A key problem with that policy is that it has lapsed 3 times. Does anybody guess the year that it's lapsed over each time?
Looks like an every other year tax credit is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's a 10-year credit, but to qualify for it, you must have the machines in the ground and operating by the December 31st of a given year. So the years that it's lapsed, it actually lapsed in the middle of 99, got renewed after it had lapsed. So in this policy uncertainty period here, almost nothing happens because people, this is a very important part of the economics, and it's roughly a third of the value of a wind power project is in these tax credits. And you don't want to put one in unless you know you're going to get that. Or if you know you're not going to get it, then you could plan accordingly and the economics change. But in the time of uncertainty, there's almost no forward activity. There's a lot of early development work during those periods, but actually putting the machines in and getting the machines running needs that policy certainty. So it also expired in 2001, expired in 2003, and it's going to expire December 31st of this year, and this number, 1,500, is probably going to be up in the 2,500 range, some forecasts. Now, the Congress passed the energy bill recently, and a extension of this production tax credit through the end of 2007 is in that, and maybe Bush has already signed it. He pledged he would. So currently, the wind power industry has a 2.5-year window of policy certainty, at least at the federal level, on that production tax credit. And that's very good news for the industry, because as you can imagine, if the auto industry sold 2,000 cars in 1 year and 400 the next, and then cycled back through that, it's just terribly disruptive for the people who make these machines and make the components for them, people who build them, and even some consultants get a little frazzled on some of these years. Go ahead, Nash. What's driving the market? There's a lot of talk about a federal renewable portfolio standard. What I mean by that is a standard that says power X percent of electricity with a renewable fuel by a certain date. So it's a date and rate goal, and it's called a portfolio standard. There's been talk at the federal level, it hasn't happened. A number of states have gone ahead and done that. California and Texas, my next slide will show some of that. And that state level, goals of getting more renewable energy into the fuel mix that makes electricity have gone a long way. The tax credit, production tax credit that I just mentioned, has broad political support on both sides of the aisle. Unfortunately, it has always been a real political football because I'm no expert in how things work in Washington, D.C., but I've been told by people who are that if something is very popular, it's sometimes very hard to get it passed because they'll want to attach it to some bill that has to go through or that doesn't have to go through because just the way the voting works. So it finally has gotten into a renewal before it's expired, and we're quite happy about that. Portfolio diversity is another key driver at this point. It doesn't make any sense if you're an electric utility to power all of your to get all of your power from one fuel source, be it coal or natural gas or hydro. All of those things can have different issues that disrupt supply, cause them to be more expensive or have other issues. If you can get a good mix of your fuels into making electricity, you're better off. And wind is kind of the up-and-coming version of that as a new source of diversity. a key part of wind power is that once you put the machines in the ground, it's relatively low cost to operate them, and there's no fuel cost in that. The wind is going to come year after year with a fairly good certainty once you establish the data on that, and you don't pay for it. With the production tax credit, which is roughly a third of the value, it's actually the low-cost energy source for a number of competitive bids that utilities have gone out for. They've been on what they call all-source bids, not necessarily going after renewables per a particular standard, but saying, hey, marketplace, get me some new electricity, and get bids from different sources, and the wind has actually won numerous times lately. So there's fairly credible goals or credible forecasts of substantial increases in the United States, up to 20,000 megawatts in about 5 years or so, and 100,000 in the next 15 years or so. These are phenomenal growth. Wind has really taken off.
That 20,000 by 2010, as a percentage of total electric energy, what's that look like?
Still fairly small, and I don't know the number. That brings up a very good point. I'm talking about wind. There's other fuels. There's other stories to be told about other fuels. And I'm excited about wind, and there's a great growth ahead. But as a matter of fact, it's still it's the fastest growing source of electricity in the United States. It's still a very small amount, and there, even though, for example, in this year there will be a record number of installed megawatts of wind power, there will be more installed conventional power, natural gas-fired power plants, as an example. So our market penetration is increasing somewhat, but the overall pie, the overall picture is such amazing growth in the United States and worldwide. We're still using a lot more electricity than we did last year and the year before that. Go ahead, Matt. Here's just an example of different states that have standards. Some of the leaders are California, with a goal of 20% by 2017. Texas has been very aggressive. That's a pretty small number, but they've actually met that in 2004, I believe, and there's talk of increasing their standard so they have a more aggressive target. A lot of this was met by wind power projects in West Texas here, and there's some more going in up here in the north part of Texas. The Northeast has some fairly aggressive goals as well. New York, a very aggressive goal, and there's a lot of wind power going in there. And that's a challenging environment to do wind, because there's not as much wind generally in the Northeast of the United States, and certainly very little in the Southeast wind-wise. Now, there's other ways to go ahead and get renewables, but at the current time, wind is the most cost-competitive of the renewable sources. Go ahead, Matt. Okay, what are some of the challenges that wind power development faces? The biggest disadvantage from a technical perspective is when the wind doesn't blow, there's no power coming out of the wind turbine. The lights in this room in this village are powered by a small hydroelectric plant just across the bridge, and it generally runs. There's water fairly predictably coming down. Bill might tell you that it's going to change over the long term, but tomorrow we can be pretty assured that the water's still going to run and the lights will still be on. That's not true with wind. It could be a windy day tomorrow, or maybe not. There's a lot of effort goes into forecasting that, but there's still not, you cannot predict it with any great certainty. You can predict it over the long term. I can say next year, this is about how much energy I'll make, but I don't know what I'm gonna make next March 27th, for example. Transmission lines are generally constrained. If you can think about long distance transmission lines as interstate highways for electricity, they have been built over many, many years, the whole system, and it's designed for the power plants that are there. And a lot of the wind in the United States is not near where the electric load is. So we can generate power, say, in North Dakota, but there's not that much demand for more power in North Dakota. We need to get it out of North Dakota and to Chicago or Spokane or what have you. So there's a lot of need for building more transmission lines to connect the source of the power and the sink of the power. You'll also hear that wind has a low capacity factor, meaning that it doesn't put out its full output all the time. That makes the transmission you have to build less efficient. That's a key disadvantage of wind. It costs a lot of money, and the policy support is variable, and a lot of people don't like to see them in their backyards. That's the NIMBY opposition. Go ahead, Matt. Okay, you may have seen these machines on the horizon. I'm going to just give you a sense of how big they are and what goes on inside them. typically each machine is rated 1 to 3 megawatts. That's 1,000 watts. I'm sorry, 1,000 kilowatts to 3,000 kilowatts. And a typical project might have a single wind turbine behind a high school, or might have hundreds out on a farm somewhere. The rotor diameter from tip to tip is roughly 55 to 90 meters across. Towers are typically 60 to 80 or 90 meters tall. And they're heavy machines. And they're very large scale. If you see these things being transported to a project, the blades just are much longer than a typical truck. And they almost look like one of those phony postcards with a big salmon on the back of a truck. Look what I come from, I think. Go ahead now. Inside the machine, before we even get inside, there are three blades attached here to a hub, slow speed shaft, there's a transmission here that speeds it up, and then a generator in back, and all sorts of ancillary components that help keep it cool, computers to control it, soundproofing, a yaw mechanism to aim it into the wind. There's a whole power plant up on top of one of those towers. Go ahead, Matt. It costs a lot of money to put up. Each machine you might see out on the horizon is roughly $1 to $2 million of investment. Relatively low cost to operate. And that's a typical pattern for a renewable power plant. It costs a lot to put it in, but you don't have to pay for the fuel. It's very different from a natural gas or coal plant, which are relatively inexpensive to produce, but you've got to be buying fuel all the time to run it. It's a very different type of life cycle cost and economics. Cost of energy is competitive with the benefit of the production tax credit, with certainly it's more competitive than the spot price of natural gas and other fossil fuels at this time. Go ahead now. And to make the project work, you need good wind. You need to have someone who's going to buy the power over the long term. So you put all this money to put in that machine, you need some certainty when you go to the bank to convince them to lend you money that you're going to get the money back over the long term as you make power over 15 to 20 years. And let's just run through this because we've run out of time. The market's growing. Europe's way ahead of us. Fuel diversity and cost are driving the market. And it costs a lot to put in, relatively low cost to operate. And we hope for increased transmission and better long-term policy to make it happen. We'll end it right there since the bell rang. I guess that was the meeting. We have a few minutes to assemble before we go down to. Anybody, feel free to leave if anybody needs to, but I'd be happy to entertain some questions.
Yeah, maybe we'll take question before we depart. Anybody
have a
question?
Go ahead. You mentioned that the variability of the wind power is a major disadvantage. What's the technology for storing power when you get a windy day versus a still day so that you could even out that?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to store electricity. It can be done, but it's very expensive. There's some means of operating the whole system to store it. In the Northwest, for example, there's a lot of storage dams that make electricity. When on a windy day, when the wind is putting out, the dams can be throttled back to make less electricity. So in effect, you're storing it behind the dam by turning that back up when the wind is low. At any given time, the load and supply of electricity are balanced within the system, so you can't really store it. The other answer to that is there's different wind projects now in geographically diverse areas, and they tend to balance each other out. So that diversity of location is helping with that issue. I will be around for a couple more days, and I'd be happy to talk about energy and wind with anybody who's
Thank you.
So inclined. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.